So it's not only my struggle, it's the struggle of every single one here in Gaza. And because we are talking about Sha'ban, Sha'ban was starved. He was immunocompromised as well. And he had gone through many times of, you know, many times of gastroenteritis, hepatitis A virus, before even being injured inside Al-Aqsa Mosque, when he was injured and he and his head was stitched up by 20 stitches. I didn't know when this barbarity and insanity will stop, but it just continues. And we could be, again, my message to the world is that I could be the next Sha'ban. Anyone could be the next Sha'ban, because Israel is allowed to do anything. There are no international laws that can prevent Israel from doing, from continuing its open war crimes in Gaza. There is no law. And even my understanding is that the international laws and the rights of living, rights of freedom for every human being around the world are enshrined into humanity, into our globe, as we call it. But the claim to humanity we're talking about just has just been exposed when this genocide started, because the double standards of the Western community are extremely devastating and also disgusting. And
Abu Bakr, I want to thank you so much for being with us, and I hate to cut you off. Thank you so much for being with us. Abu Bakr Abed writes that he looks at pictures of food on the internet. He's a 21-year-old journalist from Deir al-Balah in Gaza, standing outside the hospital where Sha'ban burned to death. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Tune in to KBOO every second Sunday of the month, 8 to 10 p.m., for Pacific Northwest Tunes, a show dedicated to showcasing our Pacific Northwest bands and musicians. That's Pacific Northwest Tunes every second Sunday of the month, 8 to 10 p.m., here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
Through this increased military and foreign investment, we've
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the United States Department of Transportation denies ODOT funding for the Rose Quarter expansion.
Portland City Council moves to end their agreement with the county for joint office.
And professors protest layoffs at Portland State University.
Good evening. This is KBOO Evening News for Friday, October 18th, 2024. I'm Hannah Francis.
And I'm Eliza Yurkov. The U.S. Department of Transportation rejected the Oregon Department of Transportation's request for $750 million for the Rose Quarter Freeway Expansion Project. ODOT would have used that money to double the width of Interstate 5 through the Albina neighborhood. Critics of the project say widening the freeway would induce demand to drive rather than alleviate traffic based on previous freeway expansion projects throughout the country. Several agencies have filed lawsuits against both transportation agencies for pursuing this project that would violate environmental standards. Organizations like Bike Portland, No More Freeways PDX, and Neighbors for Clean Air also say that the freeway expansion would worsen the environmental racism the construction of I-5 caused in the historically black Albina district. Transportation activists are in support of the project's freeway cap components. This comes just months after the announcement in March that the federal government gave a $450 million grant towards building those caps. Chris Smith, founder of No More Freeways, says, quote, "It's time for ODOT to get the message and design a project that is focused on reconnecting the community rather than widening the highway," end quote.
Portland City Commissioners Renee Gonzalez, Mingus Maps, and Dan Ryan moved to end a county partnership that runs and partially funds the Joint Office of Homeless Services. The office was founded in 2016 between Multnomah County and the City of Portland. An April audit said that the office had greatly expanded shelter in Portland and increased accessibility of shelter locations. But it needed to improve services by expanding shelter size, furthering shelter accessibility, and continuing to design programs to address racial inequities. The audit also stated that the joint office had already begun working on the feedback from the audit by the time it was published. But Gonzalez, Maps, and Ryan want out. They ask the city attorney to create an ordinance to withdraw from the partnership, setting up a vote in a few weeks. Gonzalez told the Oregonian that the city will have to collaborate with the county regardless of the current agreement, but he isn't sure that the joint office is the right model. He did not present an alternate plan going forward. Both Gonzalez and Maps are running for Portland mayor, along with Commissioner Carmen Rubio, businessman Keith Wilson, and Lieve Ostis, all of whom support keeping the joint office agreement in place. The joint office funds hundreds of local nonprofits who do the work for supporting homeless residents and getting them into shelter and housing. If the city pulls out of the agreement, that work and funding could be in jeopardy. The new city council and mayor will be sworn in before that agreement would end its 90-day closeout procedure if the current city council does actually vote to end this agreement. Building a new contract would be in the hands of the new city council. Mayor Ted Wheeler, Governor Kotek, and Commissioner Rubio have independently voiced concern for what Wheeler called a short-sighted act to end the agreement. They say it would be unwise to withdraw without a fully funded and thought-out plan to replace it first, especially with winter on its way. Oregon Governor Tina Kotek critiqued the meeting led by Gonzalez, saying, quote, "We do not have the luxury of just talking about problems. Leaders have to bring forward solutions."
Portland State University sent layoff notices to 100 non-tenure-track faculty on Tuesday. Faculty from both the American Association of University Professors Union and the PSU Faculty Association Union rallied on Thursday outside of President Ann Cudd's office. In a Board of Trustees meeting in September, Cudd said, quote, "I have no doubt that this year will be a challenging one for PSU as we get serious about financial sustainability and roll up our sleeves to become the institution that the future needs us to be," end quote. The notices come off of her tumultuous first year navigating student-led protests in solidarity with Palestine, lower enrollment rates, and an $18 million budget deficit. The layoffs also come in the middle of the AAUP bargaining session with PSU as their contract approaches its November 30th expiration date. No one has been officially laid off yet, but more concrete notices will be delivered by December 15th. Meanwhile, PSU continues fundraising for the $600 million Keller Auditorium project. Emily Ford, PSU AAUP president, said, quote, "Concrete and steel won't do anything for Portland State if there's nobody left to provide the mission-critical services of the university, which is teaching and learning," end quote.
Several international human rights groups are holding a rally outside of Portland's Arlene Schnitzer Hall on Monday, October 21st, to protest Hillary Clinton's visit on her book tour. One of the groups, the International Women's Alliance, is a coalition of women's organizations from around the world uniting to end the root causes of violence against women. The other two organizations are focused on national sovereignty and genuine democracy in the Philippines, Bayan USA, and the International Coalition for Human Rights in the Philippines, ICHRP. Though the United States granted the Philippines independence in 1946, the U.S. maintained a militarized presence until 1992. Then, in 1998, the Visiting Forces Agreement was signed, reestablishing U.S. bases in the country. Under the Obama administration in 2014, the Enhanced Defense Cooperation Agreement was signed, which led to an increased militarized presence in the Philippines as well as foreign investments. Maddie, a representative of Bayan, Oregon, explains how that has affected people in the Philippines.
Through this increased military and foreign investment, we've really just seen a massive spike in landlessness as well as lack of industry and jobs for Filipino people. Multinational corporations are taking land from peasants almost every day and ultimately has led to a lot of forced migration of the Filipino people.
As the Secretary of State during that administration, Hillary Clinton coined the term "pivot to Asia" and led the campaign to focus militarized efforts in the Indo-Pacific to further U.S. imperialism. The human rights organizations are drawing attention to Clinton's role in exacerbating Filipino exploitation as well as her hypocrisy when it comes to women's rights.
that includes women like from Libya who were victims because of the civil war that broke out after the assassination of Gaddafi under Hillary Clinton's leadership, and women in Haiti who were denied a 37-cent increase in their minimum wage under Hillary Clinton's influence.
That was Katie, a representative of the International Women's Alliance, expanding on how her policies have put women in harm's way. The goal of the rally is not just to expose Clinton's role in Filipino struggles, but also how her new book peddles U.S. imperialist messaging.
Her book really goes into a lot of detail about how stupid she thought the student encampments were, how she doesn't think anyone here really knows what they're fighting for when they stand in solidarity with Palestine.
Copeland, a representative of ICHRP, explained that even if the United States sees its first woman president this November, the international violence against women will continue as a symptom of U.S. foreign policy, especially in places like the Philippines and Palestine. These groups say they are part of a larger mass movement for global liberation, engaging with struggles across labor, faith, environmentalism, among other social justice issues. Bayan USA, the International Women's Alliance, and ICHRP are on all social media platforms. The rally is at 4 p.m. on Monday, October 21st, at the Arlene Schnitzer Hall in Portland.
Newly released body camera footage shows the Portland police officer who shot and killed Nicholas Thorne on October 4th did so as another officer was trying to de-escalate the confrontation. Officer Andrew Young shot and killed Thorne in the Brentwood-Darlington neighborhood. Police responded to calls about a domestic disturbance and found Thorne with a .22 caliber pellet gun. Nearly an hour of negotiation and de-escalation followed. The negotiating officer was coaxing Thorne down the steps to talk to her when Young shot and killed him. Bright police spotlights trained on Thorne meant the body camera footage released by Portland police is unclear as to what happened just before Young shot him. Thorne is the third person to be shot and killed by Portland police this year. Officer Young has worked for the police bureau for 7 years. Just over a year prior, Young was behind the wheel of a police car going 66 miles an hour in a 20-mile-an-hour zone on Southeast 111th. He drove through a stop sign without stopping, hitting a man driving a stolen Kia and killing him. The car slid across Holgate and crashed through a fence and into the gas gauge of a home. It's unclear if Young faced any discipline for the crash.
Longtime GOP members are supporting Kamala Harris over Donald Trump. Israel has killed the top Hamas leader in Gaza, and farmers debate how the election could impact agriculture. With more on the story is Edwin J. Vieira with 2024 Talks.
Welcome to 2024 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
At stake in this election is the Constitution of the United States, its very self. We are here today because we share a core belief that we must put country before party.
As early voting starts, Vice President Kamala Harris continues to campaign for votes from Republicans concerned about protecting democracy. A New York Times Siena College poll shows fewer than 1 in 10 Republicans might vote for her, but that's twice the number from September. Meanwhile, after repeatedly dodging the question, Ohio Senator J.D. Vance has clearly said he thinks former President Donald Trump won in 2020. The Republican VP nominee has long said the election was unfair, as when he told a crowd in North Carolina that social media companies were biased.
In 2020, large technology companies censored Americans from talking about things like the Hunter Biden laptop story, and that had a major, major consequence on the election.
Vance's Democratic opponent Tim Walz says denying the 2020 results means Vance is more loyal to Trump than to America, and the Minnesota governor points to Trump swaying to music for 40 minutes at a town hall instead of taking questions as more evidence that he's unqualified.
It would be funny if this guy were not running for president of the United States. And it would be funny if you knew that this guy, if he shuts down like he did last night, you know he's doing that when he's sitting in the Situation Room.
Hamas leader Yahya Sinwar was killed by Israeli Defense Forces in Gaza. Sinwar was the mastermind behind the October 7th attack. State Department spokesman Matthew Miller says he was also a main obstacle to a ceasefire.
The path that Sinwar wanted for the region, death, destruction, instability, chaos, is a path that we know the people of the region reject. The horrors of the past year cannot be the future, and they do not need to be the future.
Some Wisconsin college students report getting threatening text messages that warn of fines or jail if they vote vote when not eligible. Molly Carmichael with the League of Women Voters in Wisconsin herself just graduated and got one of the messages. She says the first thing she noticed was the harsh language.
Right off the bat, I was pretty upset because I figured this was also going out to other people, maybe people who have never voted before and are excited to vote this November. And so getting a text like that would certainly be really alarming.
Congress is overdue to pass a new farm bill, with some observers saying it's waiting for the election. Nebraska's Farmers Union President John Hansen says they broadly support Trump's eagerness to impose tariffs, but in cases like trade with China, President Joe Biden has been more effective by being more selective.
If you're going to turn the use of a tool that has this kind of impact loose, you really do need to have an informed set of public officials that help discuss these things and help calibrate what we're doing so that we're doing things in a thoughtful and coherent way.
Hansen says they will work with whoever wins. I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin. At 6, it's Civic Cipher. Then at 7, KBOO presents Running on Air. On this episode, the hosts of all the different episodes will share their reflections on the series so far. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with a chance of rain, around 56 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will also be mostly cloudy, getting up to 69 degrees. Today in history, Mr. October helps the New York Yankees win the World Series against the LA Dodgers in 1977. Reggie Jackson, an outfielder for the Yankees, hit 3 home runs in a row off of 3 consecutive pitches from 3 different pitchers, adding to the final 8-3 score. The quote of the day is from the 1954 swampy motion picture, Creatures from the Black Lagoon. The captain, Lucas, entices his passengers, saying, quote, "I can tell you something about this place. The boys around here call it the Black Lagoon, a paradise. Only they say nobody has ever come back to prove it."
The U.S. Department of Treasury announces $500 million in state Small Business Credit Initiative capital program applications. The Episcopal Church in Wyoming returned more than 200 cultural and sacred items to the Northern Arapaho tribe earlier this week, and the Alaska Federation of Natives Convention this year pushes to restore subsistence rights. With that story and more, it's Brian Bull with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bowles, sitting in for Antonia Gonzalez. In what it says is the largest federal investment in small businesses across Indian country, the U.S. Department of the Treasury announced the approval of over $500 million in state Small Business Credit Initiative capital program applications. The milestone is reached with the approval of nearly $87 million for the Cherokee Nation. Its principal chief, Chuck Hoskin Jr., says small businesses are the lifeblood of the local economy across the reservation.
For many people across the country who are involved in small business, access to capital may not be as difficult as it is in Indian country. So this will provide the working capital that brilliant entrepreneurs who are either starting businesses or expanding businesses need. Things that many people take for granted, like franchise fees, buying equipment, inventory, production services.
The historic amount was also reached with 8 other SSBCI applications worth an additional $15 million. Treasury officials have also announced 2 competitive technical assistance awards through the SSBCI Investing in America Small Business Opportunity Program for the Cherokee and Chickasaw Nations. The Episcopal Church in Wyoming returned more than 200 cultural and sacred items to the Northern Arapaho tribe earlier this week. They'd been in the church's possession for almost 80 years. Wyoming Public Radio's Hannah Haberman has the story.
A couple hundred people gathered in a grassy field at St. Michael's Circle in Ethity for a coming home celebration.
This is very historical for us to get our artifacts back.
That's Northern Arapaho Elder Marion Scott addressing the crowd.
I am just so proud that they are back home, and they're going to stay here with us now.
Over a plate of stew and bread after the ceremony, Northern Arapaho member Jordan Dresser called it a full circle moment.
I feel lucky to have been a part of this journey, but also to see it complete is something I never thought would happen.
And moving forward?
I'm just excited for what's the next possibilities, which is creating a museum where we tell who we are as Arapaho people.
I'm Hannah Haberman on the Wind River Reservation.
For Alaska Natives, the right to hunt and fish has been a long-running battle that goes back well before statehood. There's a push at the Alaska Federation of Natives Convention this year to restore subsistence rights that the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act, known as ANILCA, was supposed to guarantee. Congress passed it in 1980. Alaska Natives originally fought for a native preference, but settled for a rural priority for hunting and fishing. But courts have determined that the state's constitution doesn't allow for a rural priority. So today, the state has two systems of fish and game management. The chairman of AFN's Subsistence Committee, Gayla Hossett, says it's time for a complete overhaul of subsistence management.
We're trying to go back to getting our Aboriginal hunting and fishing rights back. When you look at it, is what has the state and federal government done to protect our subsistence way of life? That's a loaded question.
The AFN Subsistence Committee has drafted a resolution that calls for Alaska Natives to oversee subsistence on Native Corporation lands. It also looks at reopening not only ANILCA, but the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. The AFN convention is the state's largest gathering, drawing thousands of people to Anchorage. And 30 years ago this week, the United States Postal Service issued its Legends of the West stamps, featuring several prominent historical figures. This included Apache military leader and medicine man Geronimo, Sacagawea, who was the Shoshone guide and interpreter for the Lewis and Clark expedition, and Chief Joseph of the Nez Perce. This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull in the KLCC studios of Eugene, Oregon.
Hundreds gathered at the annual Fermentation Festival, nicknamed Stinkfest, last Thursday as dozens of local businesses showcased their inventory of merchandise and expertise. The festival sold out this year with enthusiasts of all types of aged foods from kombucha and kefir to natto and sauerkraut in attendance. Cornerstone Portland restaurants and food providers like Jorinji Miso, Vitopian Cheese, and Oregon Brine Works tabled the event. They provided samples of their classic eats, as well as new experiments like Obon Shokudo's two-year-old miso, Wanpaku Natto's pinto bean natto, and Reverend Nat's chicken garum. The event started in 2009 when founder and organizer Liz Crane reached out to the fermentation community in Portland and asked to gather and share their skills and products.
I started fermenting shortly after moving to Portland. I just had a really fruitful garden. And then I met some other fermentation friends, and we thought, well, we should start something in Portland where we can all come together and skill share. One of the main reasons why we have the festival is to try and get people to realize that they can do this.
The event is really a fermentation of its own. It has aged for 15 years and continues to develop a devout gathering of exhibitors and enthusiasts alike, sharing bacterial and human cultures. The festival has transformed from a Skillshare amongst a niche community into a sold-out public event that barely fits into its original event space at the EcoTrust building. Fellow organizer Heidi Nessler from Wanpaku Natto expands on that.
Thinking back to that first festival, the connections I made then are friendships I have today. So I see people come through the table, they're people I've known for years. It's a very tight-knit group, and I really feel like I had a lot of connections with a lot of the different fermenters.
Claudia Lucero, the third organizer for this year's event, is the founder and cheesemaker at Urban Cheesecraft, a Latina woman-owned cheese and cheesemaking kit business in Portland. She told OPB, quote, "So there's the community building, and I think like a jar of sauerkraut or a wheel of brie, we're working in a relationship with these bacteria, providing the perfect environment for their growth and for thriving for them to not go in the bad direction, right? Where it's not a control, but it's a relationship," end quote. Most of the vendors at the festival are connected through another local business, Beeline Delivery, a micromobility delivery service. Tegan Velo told us about the vendors this company works with that were at the festival.
I'd say hi to Humi, who I've worked with in the past. There's Soybeam is here with Ernest, demoing some of their misos also. Tortuga Gordo Hot Sauces is a new one, a tasty fermented hot sauce.
Bond Dance PDX led attendees in a playful dance around the rooms, like the ingredients that mix and play with each other as we wait for them to transform. They hosted a fermentation-themed Bon Odori, a Japanese folk dance that honors life and harvest. The band Imagine Bon Odori wrote the song they danced to, with their lyrics encapsulating the atmosphere of the night, quote, "A bowl of miso soup in the morning, pickles, natto, and yogurt drink. Intestinal bacteria dance hand in hand. The world is peaceful and fermented," end quote. A special guest added to the revelry, quietly entering the cacophony of fizzes, chatter, and chewing. Dylan the Pickle from the Portland Pickles baseball team traveled through the doors on a lilting path of stink waves towards the brine and tang. We had a few questions for the anthropogenic representative of the community.
How long did it take for you to ferment?
Unfortunately, he doesn't talk, so we'll never know his secrets. Fermentation is a celebration of life, a conspicuous nod to how we can thrive in collaboration. This festival embodied that philosophy. It allowed everyone to slow down and appreciate the goodness we can make, especially with each other, while we appreciate each other's histories and cultures.
The Oregon State Election Division is closed for calls for a second day after shutting down Thursday amid a flood of out-of-state callers. They were responding to a false claim made on social media that Republican nominee Donald Trump was not included in the voter pamphlet. Trump is in the voters' pamphlet, but his campaign decided to put a statement in it, about why voters would choose him. He's on Oregonian's ballot, too, along with six other candidates, but the false claim was referenced by hundreds of callers, who the Secretary of State's office described as abusive and threatening. The Statesman Journal listened to one call from a New York area code. They say the caller used vulgar language and threatened to, quote, "finish you all off" for, quote, "taking Trump and Vance off the ballot." The Secretary of State's office says they'll send threatening calls to Oregon State Police and the FBI. Today, the Election Division is screening their calls, and if the caller is from Oregon with a specific question, they can expect a call back. Officials say they expect normal operations to resume on Monday.
A community in Puerto Rico, Nuestra Señora del Carmen Parish in Cataño, is taking bold steps to become a climate resilience hub. They're preparing for future storms by installing solar energy systems. With details and more, it's Trimmel Gomes.
In preparation for future storms, a parish in Puerto Rico, Nuestra Señora del Carmen Parish in Cataño, has installed a solar power system, positioning itself as a vital climate resilience hub for the local community. This coastal community is taking proactive steps to ensure it can remain a beacon of support during the increasing threats of hurricanes. Speaking on a webinar, David Ortiz, Puerto Rico Director of Solar United Neighbors, says there is a critical need for resilience following the devastation of Hurricane Maria in 2017.
There were over 4,600 deaths. People lost electricity from 3 months to a year. Many also lost water from 3 to 6 months. Flooding devastating many towns and municipalities, including Cataño.
The parish's new solar installation, completed in March, is designed to sustain high winds and keep the church operational in the event of a power outage. A key aspect of the resilience hub is its ability to support vulnerable members of the community during emergencies to access things like electricity, shelter, and drinking water. The parish's solar system features advanced technology to ensure consistent power, even in challenging conditions. Ortiz says each panel has its own microinverter, which means that even if one panel is damaged, the rest of the system will continue to function.
You know, these weather events are getting more and more stronger every time, but it's what we do day one that starts to prepare us to become much more resilient. And be able to weather these events.
The parish's solar system will play a key role in helping fortify the community's preparedness for the next big storm. This is Trimmel Gomes for Florida News Connection. This story was produced with original reporting by Rebecca Randall for Earthbeat.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, October 18th, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Hannah Francis, Althea Billings, and Eliza Yurkov. The producer is Eliza Yurkov, and our engineer is Jasmine Moss. Special thanks to Eric Tegadoff, Trimmel Gomes, Danielle Smith, Crystal Blair, Brian Bull, Edwin J. Vieira, and Mike Moen. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Hannah Francis.
And I'm Eliza Yurkov. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our wonderful members. If you would like to become a wonderful member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, there is other news, of course.